From WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. The magnificent ramshorn snail and the Greenfield ramshorn snail haven't been found in the wild for more than a decade. While the names assigned to these creatures might sound imposing, the two types of ramshorn snails are relatively small animals. They're also indigenous to the Cape Fear region. Andy Wood's efforts to save the magnificent ramshorn are well documented. Biologist Sarah McCrae with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service recounts a time in 1996 when Hurricane Fran pounded the North Carolina coast and Andy Wood rushed outside braving floodwaters and high winds to save what may have been some of the last remaining magnificent ramshorn snails on Earth. If you've been a WHQR listener for more than a decade, you might remember Andy Wood's wildly popular nature commentaries. He's worked as education curator at the North Carolina Aquarium at Fort Fisher for Audubon, North Carolina, and he now runs his own nonprofit called Coastal Plain Conservation Group. He joins us today. Andy Wood, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you here, and long overdue. In fact, you are responsible, I think, for my irrational love of tiny green tree frogs. But we're not talking about those today. We're talking about snails. And just as a reminder, today's conversation is pre-recorded. So there are these two different types of ramshorn snails, the magnificent ramshorn and the Greenfield ramshorn. What's the difference?
They are cousins. They're in the same family. They are lunged snails, but they live in water. So they can extract oxygen to a limited degree from water. More importantly, they skim the surface of the water hanging just under the film of water tension, and they are able to extract oxygen from air by skimming under the surface of the water. The Greenfield ramshorn is very small. As an adult, they're 5 millimeters across, so smaller than your pinky nail. The magnificent ramshorn is its giant cousin, somewhat analogous to an elephant in an aquatic system. They're a big snail. They grow to over an inch across, which, you know, some people familiar with snails might think an inch is huge. It is for a lunged snail. It's actually the largest lunged aquatic snail in North America, and quite possibly the rarest snail in North. Well, the rarest would be Greenfield ramshorn.
Why is the magnificent ramshorn, or why to a layperson does it appear to be so much better documented and written about than the Greenfield ramshorn?
Probably because since 1992, I've been trying to prevent its extinction. So there are reports that I've had to prepare, you know, annual reports on the status of what is a state-listed endangered species. It is state-listed. It's not federally listed.
You're talking about magnificent right now.
Correct. Yeah, the magnificent ramshorn is a candidate endangered species.
What does that mean, candidate endangered species?
It is being reviewed by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service right now for inclusion as an endangered species.
So when will they make a decision on that?
Well, I've been asking them to do that since 1994. And backing up just a little, if I can. This is a somewhat controversial animal because it is rare for pretty much a singular reason now. Historically, we know Planorbella magnifica, the magnificent ramshorn, and Greenfield ramshorn. They both inhabited just this area and are literally only known from, in the case of magnificent ramshorn, they're known from four distinct localities. And that's it. One in New Hanover County, Greenfield Lake, and three ponds in Brunswick County. That's it. Talk about a restricted range. So
when were these first written about?
In the late 1800s, they were discovered and pretty much lost to science. A note was made that, hey, well, we found this neat snail down in this place called southeastern North Carolina near Wilmington. But they were somewhat lost to science and then rediscovered in the 1920s or so, and then named in the 1930s. So they've been known for a while. It's just there's very little known about them until recent time.
So what caused their disappearance then?
The first wave was probably due to eradicating the beaver that was here. There are a couple of subspecies of beavers. There's the Canadian beaver, Castor canadensis, that everybody is familiar with around here. But there was a subspecies in this area called the Carolina beaver, Castor carolinensis. And that was our very own beaver. So they inhabited the swamps.
And when you say our very own, do you mean North Carolina?
Yes, south, pretty much the coastal plain of North Carolina. And I believe most of North Carolina, for that matter. The Canadian beaver is a more northern species of beaver that has been introduced to our area. And so in the 1800s, beaver harvesting, beaver hunting for their pelts, basically eliminated the animal from much of its range. And both of these snails are, they inhabit what we call lentic systems, which is a fancy word that just means slow-moving water. So that would be a slow-moving stream or a pond, notably a beaver pond, built in one of those slow-moving streams, which meander throughout southeastern North Carolina. They are connected to various rivers, the Northeast Cape Fear, Black River, the Cape Fear River. So these small streams would be dammed up by beavers. The beaver family would occupy an area for generations. So the ponds would have a lifespan of generations, of many, many years, long enough to establish a specific plant called spatterdock. It's a common water lily. And the snails use the underside of the water lily leaf as an attachment point for their eggs. So the snails somewhat co-evolved with beavers in this area, in beaver ponds. And why they are so restricted to this area, we're still trying to figure that out. It probably has something to do with the age of this ecosystem. What people see in southeastern North Carolina today is an eco in natural areas. That's pretty much what it looked like here upwards of 8,000 to 10,000 years ago.
When do you recall first learning about the green, the tiny version of the ramshorn snail, the Greenfield ramshorn, and when was that last found in the wild?
I'm sure I knew about Greenfield right when I was introduced to Magnifica. And I was introduced to the magnificent ramshorn by a dear friend, Bill Adams, formerly with the Corps of Engineers and now doing work as a pastor. He called me one day out of the blue when I was at the aquarium back in 92. And he knew, actually coincidentally, from my radio commentaries that I liked little things. And so he asked if I'd be interested in helping him try to find Magnifica. So we spent summer of 92 searching every pond and stream that we could legally get into. I was a state employee, he was a federal employee, so we were very careful about trespass. So we couldn't get everywhere we wanted to, but we got most places. And it just so happens one of the last ponds on a hot day in August, lo and behold, we found Magnifica in Brunswick County. So in our conversations, Bill regaled me with many, many stories about many, many different kinds of snails and crayfish and other things that he works with. So I've known about Greenfield, but his lament was Greenfield is gone. The presumption in 1992 is that Greenfield ramshorn was extinct. So it was just incredible that it was found in 1994. And
who found it in 94?
A graduate student at UNCW, and I believe her first name was Sarah Brady. I believe, and my apology if I got that wrong. But she was a grad student. I'm not sure what she was working on, but she was dip netting in Town Creek looking for snails and other micro or macro invertebrates.
Town Creek in Brunswick County.
Correct. A tributary to the Cape Fear. And she found a bunch of snails, delivered them to Bill and a couple of other people, and they identified Greenfield Ramshorn. And you could hear everybody cheering. It was incredible.
So then they're actually living in the wild, or are they?
At that time, no. We're pretty certain that Greenfield is now gone from the wild, primarily due to saltwater intrusion as a direct consequence of dredging the Cape Fear River, which is North Carolina's largest river basin contained entirely within the state, and the largest river in the state that communicates directly with the Atlantic Ocean. The other major rivers, Tar, Neuse, Pamlico, and Roanoke, they all discharge into a sound or into a bay. But the Cape Fear communicates directly with the ocean, the Great Ocean.
And because these are freshwater snails, saltwater intrusion is the death of them.
They are incredibly salt intolerant. One part per thousand salt will kill them. We measure ocean salinity in parts per thousand. So, and the ocean is typically 35 parts per thousand salt.
You're listening to Coastline. Ecologist and conservation educator Andy Wood is my guest today. When we come back from this short break, we'll learn more about his efforts to raise the Ramshorn snails in captivity and find out why they're so important to the Cape Fear region's ecological system. Today's conversation is pre-recorded. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline, I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Andy Wood is well known in the Cape Fear region for his work at the North Carolina Aquarium at Fort Fisher, Audubon, North Carolina, and his years producing popular nature commentaries for WHQR. He now runs the nonprofit Coastal Plain Conservation Group, and he's working hard to save two indigenous snails from extinction, the magnificent Ramshorn snail and the Greenfield Ramshorn snail, and he is my guest today. Today's conversation is pre-recorded. Andy Wood, the UN's Intergovernmental Science Policy Platform on Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services, released a species report just last month, and the conclusions sound the alarm. It says around 1 million animal and plant species are now threatened with extinction, many within decades, more than ever before in human history. To bring this down to a local level, help us understand why non-critterly people should care about these little snails. What do they do for the local ecosystem?
Much as we know about the snails, there's still a lot we don't know. The most important thing to understand about aquatic snails, freshwater snails in particular, is they help carry energy through the ecosystem. When plants die, the snails chew them up. When a fish dies and sinks to the bottom, the snails will feed on that. They are one transition in the flow of energy. Energy is not a cyclic thing, it is a flow. So don't think of it as a circle of life, it's a flow of life. So the snails are processing nutrients in an aquatic system, making decomposing plants available to other eaters of things, including little teensy critters, Daphnia, copepods, amphipods, ostracods, all these little things with squiggly legs. Related to shrimps and lobsters, including crayfish. We even have our very own species of crayfish endemic to southeastern North Carolina called the Croatan crayfish. The only place in the world you can find Croatan crayfish is right here in southeastern North Carolina.
Is this typical for an area to have? There are so many species that I've heard about as a layperson through the years that are indigenous to the Cape Fear region or mm-hmm. southeastern North Carolina. Is this spectacular biodiversity, or is this typical for just corners of, I mean, how often do regions have their own indigenous species and this many of them?
You used the right word, spectacular. This, where we sit in southeastern North Carolina, this part of the larger ecoregion we call the Atlantic Coastal Plain, we have right here more species of plants and wildlife than anywhere on the Atlantic Coastal Plain north of Florida. Sadly, New Hanover County was the epicenter of that biodiversity. In other words, New Hanover County itself could brag the greatest number of species of plants and wildlife on the Atlantic seaboard north of Florida.
Are there identifiable reasons for that, that level of biodiversity?
There are. Part of it is the age of this ecoregion. We've been outside of the ocean for many, many thousands of years, so that has given time as an essential element of an ecosystem coming into development. So time, climate, and other factors play into how a region's community of plants and wildlife develops. So our community of plants and wildlife have been able to develop over a good 80,000 years. Even with the last ice age, we weren't warm. It was very cold here during the 25,000-30,000 years ago. We'd be in parkas. It was like the Canada tundra, very dry, very windy, very, very cold. The ice caps were just up in the Ohio Valley. They weren't here, but it was brutally cold here.
And you said, sadly, New Hanover County was the seat of this biodiversity. Why sadly?
Sadly, because it no longer can boast that. And that's just due to the rampant growth that's occurred here. So many people wanted to come move to this area to enjoy the beauty of this place. And we have quite literally cooked the goose that laid the golden eggs, and I'm sad to say that we're now scrambling the eggs.
Is there any way that this area could have grown its human population without scrambling the eggs? I mean, where did we, other than the fact that the world population continues to grow, southeastern North Carolina is one of the most rapidly growing areas along the eastern seaboard. Brunswick County is the fastest growing county in the state of North Carolina, and I think the fourth fastest growing county in the country. Mm-hmm. In light of that, is there anything that we could have done?
There are some small things we could have done that would have benefited the more common species that are in this area. For example, the pretty much standard practice today is to clear a corner, a property corner to corner, whether it's a 30-acre tract of land for development or if it's a single lot. We come in with heavy equipment and clear it corner to corner, not acknowledging the fact that in a given acre of land, you've got upwards of $40,000 to $50,000 worth of landscape material ready for you to use in your soon-to-be new home. But we don't take into account the existing ecosystem. We just clear it corner to corner. And when you do that, you lose the box turtles, the spotted turtles, the toads and lizards. All of those things are displaced. So could we have done it differently? Yeah, we could do away with the clear corner to corner. We could do away with the speculative clear corner to corner and hope that one day somebody buys what is now a denuded tract of land. And very quickly, getting back to your earlier point regarding the extinction underway right now, when we talk about a million species in danger of extinction in the next decades, I bristle a little bit at the timeline given. When Al Gore was talking about climate change 2100, I was begging him to quit saying 2100 because, and I invited him down here so that I could show him evidence of climate change back in 2008.
What kind of response did you get?
He's a politician and he was selling a book and I was cramping his style, I guess. He never took me up on the offer, but I quite literally did call him out.
But you take issue with this idea that it's a million species.
Oh, I don't doubt that it's a million. I think that's conservative. What I doubt is saying decades from now. We need to quit putting off what is happening right now. So will it be 20 years before this species becomes extinct, or will it be tomorrow? We're losing species right now. And to your question about the value of a small snail, ask the blue whale the value of plankton. Or ask a mosquito fish, which I've got a jar full here. Guppies look just like a mosquito fish. Mosquito fish eat mosquito larvae. So ask the mosquito fish, what's the value of a mosquito larvae? Well, it's their food. The snails are food for animals. All aquatic snails are likely to be consumed by turtles and various species of fish. So in part, that's how they are helping carry energy through the ecosystem. The snails feed on decomposing plants. They help decompose the plants. And in turn, they're food for something that is in turn food for something that is in turn on up the food pyramid, eaten by something. And then at the top of the pyramid sits humans.
Do we know enough about these snails yet and their role in the ecosystem to know if their disappearance from the wild has impacted any other creatures in the wild?
That's a valid question. This particular species, both of them, Greenfield and Magnifica, were never terribly common. They are somewhat like the ivory-billed woodpecker, in my mind. I view the magnificent ram's horn in the same light as an ivory bill. And Greenfield ram's horn, to me, is the Carolina parakeet. Neither of those birds were as common as certain sparrows and crows and blackbirds, but they play a role in the environment all the same. And the strength of an ecosystem is contingent on its diversity. If you have an ecosystem composed of just a few species, if you lose one of those species, that has a much greater impact on the overall health and well-being of the ecosystem. Whereas if you have lots of different species, you lose one of them, the system can still move along. Think of species and individual species as an analogy, like a rivet in an airplane. How many rivets can you afford to lose before the airplane is no longer airworthy? And I use that analogy because planet Earth is our spaceship. We're spinning through the universe we would be a finite system were it not for sunlight. We're not a closed system because we get sunlight from a distant star. So what will happen when this snail, if it goes extinct, when it goes extinct, nobody's going to know it except me. But I can say the same about a blue whale. When the blue whale goes extinct, the ocean is not going to collapse.
Is it possible that there will be consequences from the extinction of a tiny creature like the Greenfield ram's horn snail that we couldn't predict?
Without a doubt. But it wouldn't be something that's necessarily going to impact our great-grandchildren. It will have an impact at a macro scale, or a micro scale, I should say. And I don't know what that impact will be. I know that ice cream to magnificent ram's horn are the mature fruiting capsule that is developed from the flower. They love the tissue of that developing seed capsule, and they devour it with gusto. And as they're chewing it, it's really cool. At night, you watch them chewing. They'll they'll gather on this mature capsule and chew on the soft tissue, and you see the seeds raining down through the water column. They're heavier than water. The seeds drip out of the water column and settle to the bottom. So is there some connection here whereby the snails are releasing seeds from the capsule before some animal comes along and eats the seeds in the capsule and prevents the water lily from germinating? One thing that's different today is the animals and plants that were here when Magnifica was getting its start, they're no longer here. The megafauna aren't here anymore. We don't have bison and muskox and dire wolf and flat-faced bear and giant sloth. They're not walking around in this area anymore. They've been gone for 10, 12,000 years.
You're listening to Coastline Today. It's a conversation with ecologist and conservation educator and snail expert, Andy Wood. We're learning why he's working so hard to save the magnificent ramshorn snail and the Greenfield ramshorn snail. This discussion is pre-recorded. National Geographic reported earlier this year on George, a Hawaiian tree snail who was the last known member of his species. George died on New Year's Day, January 1st, 2019. He was 14, which is old for a snail of his kind. And there was one evolutionary biologist, Rebecca Rundell, who's quoted in this piece in National Geographic. She talks about being angry about it, in part, she says, because no one even knew about the issue or knew that the snail was on the verge of extinction. And now he's gone. So let's talk about your efforts to create protected populations of the Greenfield ramshorn and the magnificent ramshorn. You started with one of them. Right.
Magnifica,
the bigger one.
In 92.
So tell us how you created your own population of snails in captivity. And do you think that they know they're captives?
No. I doubt they have that sense of cognition. But it started on that August day with Bill Adams when we found the snails. I brought them into captivity. Took them to the aquarium and just set up tanks at the aquarium and was going to keep them there. But the atmosphere in the building is so salty that the salt was getting in the water, and the snails immediately withdrew into their shell and sank to the bottom of the tank.
You're talking about the air in the aquarium.
The air in the building.
At North Carolina Aquarium at Fort Fisher.
Yeah.
How did you even figure that out? How did that even occur to you, that it might be the salt content in the air that was affecting the snails?
We knew, Bill knew from other research that had been done back in the 30s, that the snail was salt intolerant. And we didn't know how salt intolerant. That was the earliest work I did with them, was trying to determine at what level is salt a problem. And it turns out less than one part per thousand, it's a problem. So as soon as I saw them withdrawing into the shell, I scooped them out of that tank and took them home and usurped our son's wading pool and turned that into their first holding quarters at home, where they've been ever since. So
Did you have any problem getting them to mate or reproduce?
No, the snail is a short-lived, relative to George, short-lived species. They have a two-year lifespan.
George, the Hawaiian tree snail.
The tree snail, correct. So these snails live 2 years. They reproduce, as I mentioned earlier, they place eggs on the underside of water lily leaves, and the eggs take usually about 2 weeks to hatch. And the offspring are about a millimeter and a half across, so very tiny. And they grow very, very quickly. They double their size in days, feeding on detritus primarily, what we call biofilm, which is the gerg that coats anything underwater.
The gerg. Is that a scientific term? That's so evocative.
I'm not sure about that. It might be a scientific term.
It's certainly an onomatopoeia.
I'll take your word for that.
Okay.
So they graze on this biofilm, this mayonnaise coating everything in a pond, and grow very quickly. By year one, they are typically about the size of a marble. And then in the second year, they get up to the size of about a shooter marble. And then they are fully mature, and it takes two for them to reproduce. They are but this particular snail contains both male and female parts, but they have to they can't self-pollinate, so to speak. They have to cross with another of their species to produce viable eggs.
And the Greenfield ram's horn, when did you take that into captivity, and how are they doing in your collection?
I think of Greenfield somewhat as being an enigmatic animal, if that's the right word, because even though I have them in 300-gallon tanks, I don't find them very often, even in those these contained aquaria, which are as much plant as water when you look at them. There's lots of plants in these tanks, the water lily and other species of aquatic plants from our area. So in the tanks, I've tried to reproduce their natural environment. And Greenfield is small, so I'll put traps in the tanks and bait them with prepared foods, lettuces and others, trying to see if I can confirm that Greenfield are still in there. I brought them into captivity in 2008 when it appeared Town Creek was starting to decline as a consequence of a drought that started in 06 and persisted through 12.
And we're going to hear more about your population, if you still have them, of Greenfield ram's horn snails and who else you've given them to. You're listening to Coastline, talking with ecologist and conservation educator Andy Wood today when we come back from this short break. More on the impact of the magnificent and Greenfield ram's horn snails on the Cape Fear ecology. And we'll also find out about these critters that are all over the Coastline studio table. Today's conversation is pre-recorded. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Andy Wood wrote and produced nature commentaries for WHQR for many years. He served as education curator at the North Carolina Aquarium at Fort Fisher in the 1980s. He later worked for Audubon North Carolina, and he now heads up his own nonprofit, Coastal Plain Conservation Group, with an eye to protecting indigenous species. Two of the critters Wood is particularly concerned about are snails. The magnificent ram's horn snail and the Greenfield ram's horn snail are not currently found in the wild. Andy Wood has given away some of his collection in captivity to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, as well as a veterinarian school in North Carolina. But we are talking about the magnificent ram's horn that you've given away, Andy Wood, mm-hmm. not the Greenfield ram's horn.
Right. Right now, the Greenfield is just not on anybody's radar. It is a state-listed endangered species, but nobody, as far as I know, is doing anything with it other than myself. I've got it in captivity. I found some individuals 2 days ago, so I know it's not extinct. But that's the only reason we know it is not extinct, is because it happens to be in my captive care, which is, that's a tiring thing to have to say. If these were ivory-billed woodpeckers and Carolina parakeets that I referenced earlier, it would be phenomenal how much support going to protect these little snails. And my reason for working with these snails is to prevent their extinction, for sure. But I use them in education programs to draw attention to the ecosystem that they represent, so to speak. They are sentinel species. They are flagship species. They are umbrella species. They just happen to be snails. We use all of those terms in ecology and conservation, but usually it's applied to something like a wolf or a bear or a whale, Not a snail.
So why is it if the green field, the tiny ram's horn snails, probably don't exist in the wild anymore, why are they not protected? Are they protected? What exactly is their designation?
Their only designation is they are state-listed endangered species. So you have to have a permit from the state of North Carolina to possess them.
And what does it mean about their protection?
Pretty much nothing, other than you have, if you wanted to keep them, you have to get a permit.
So what could possibly be habitat for them is not, there aren't any special permits that need to be obtained if there's going to be any kind of alteration to an area that might be a habitat for these snails.
Ooh, you're raising a real sensitive point there. Because if these two snails become listed as endangered, the bridge project that's been in the news lately, we would have
You're talking about Cape Fear Crossing.
Right. We'd have to go in and do surveys to make sure that the snails are not there. And that's a cost. That's an expense that would have to be encumbered by state and federal agencies and even private contractors that may want to do the work with the bridge. Just the same as we have to do surveys for other existing endangered species, whether it's bald eagle, peregrine falcon, you name it. Whatever the endangered species is, we are bound by law to make sure that we're not doing something that creates an undue burden on that species.
So this has just been the hard part for me to understand in my research before talking with you about this. If the magnificent ram's horn snail is a candidate for the endangered species list, and you said this snail has been a candidate since 2010.
And okay. Normally a species is given candidate status, and in a matter of months, it is decided whether it warrants listing as endangered.
So candidate status just means it's under consideration for
Correct.
The endangered species list.
Mm-hmm.
So this has been a candidate for 9 years now.
In spite of knowing for a fact, it's, as far as we know of fact, it is not in the wild. It's for 27 years, it's been in one person's yard.
It seems like there would be some sort of equation or a certain list of factors that would have to be present or data that's been gathered
right.
to make this land on the endangered species list. Is that what, I mean, what are we waiting for?
I don't know. And I don't want to come across cynical. The Fish and Wildlife Service, I have lots of friends and colleagues that work in that agency. Many of them are running a little nervous right now. If you make waves, there's a real good chance you're going to lose everything that you worked your career to get. It's not a good time in the game of the environment right now. So
it's a political process,
it's all
is
politics.
What you're saying.
It's all politics. If we were being truly science-based conservationists, the species would have been listed well over a decade ago. But if it gets listed as endangered, the reason it is in trouble has to do with dredging the Cape Fear River to facilitate shipping to the state port. When you see all of those dead cypress trees up and down the river, and I know they're locally referred to as ghost trees, that's too sentimental. That's not serious enough. They're way more than just ghost trees. Those trees are telling us the Cape Fear River is in rapid transition, and not necessarily in a good direction.
Describe where people would regularly see this when they're
Smith Creek. Mm-hmm. If you drive on Martin Luther King Boulevard, you'll see dead cypress trees all around Wilmington. And that is a consequence of saltwater intrusion facilitated by dredging the Cape Fear River, which communicates with the ocean. So saltwater is coming up and is quite literally creating the collapse of tens of thousands of acres of our bottomland hardwood swamp. So if it gets listed as endangered, somebody would be in a position to request the Corps of Engineers to mitigate the damage they have done to our ecosystem.
And without getting too much into the weeds of the politics of this, because mm-hmm. we are talking about the species, but would it be similar to needing to get a permit to dredge during certain seasons, for instance, around some of the barrier islands
yes.
in this region? You right. can't dredge during certain seasons because of sea turtle nesting happening mm-hmm. and other issues. Is that what it would be akin to?
It would be akin to that. They would have to do a survey to see if the snails are there. Part of the issue of introducing them back into the wild is if the species does get listed endangered and they have been introduced back into the wild, that could create an economic hardship for somebody. So there are lots of factors that go into species management.
So Andy Wood, you arrived here today with jars of all kinds of different animals. And I'm looking at one in front of me that looks like a newt. Mm-hmm. She's got a tail. She's got a broken red stripe. What is her role in this conversation? And how old is she? Who is she? You've raised her from an egg.
I did. I know. It's demented probably. But
it's beautiful.
So I brought in a backup band, so to speak, because this area, we boast about southeastern North Carolina's biodiversity, and that extends beyond just the simple counting of species. We've got 1,200 different kinds of plants in this area. We have more species of frogs in southeastern North Carolina than anywhere in North America, except a couple of places in Georgia and a couple of places in Florida. We have 35 different kinds of snakes. It's phenomenal, the diversity we have, but not just in pure numbers, but also in terms of species found nowhere else in the world. The most familiar plant in the world is arguably the Venus's flytrap, which is, I've brought one of those here as well.
Also
and
indigenous to southeastern
it's
North Carolina.
Found here in south, from basically Carteret County to Horry County, South Carolina. Many people know the flytrap and know that it's just in this little area. But who knew about the Croatan crayfish or the broken striped newt that you mentioned, which is it's a type of salamander. There are more kinds of salamanders in the mountains of North Carolina than anywhere in the world. So it's not just southeast North Carolina that's diverse. It's the whole state. The broken striped newt is our very own newt. I've actually taken people from Europe on eco tours that wanted to see that newt in the wild. And I was showing them fly traps and pitcher plants and red-cockaded woodpeckers, and really they just wanted to see that newt in the wild. Europeans love newts. They've got their own species. And they literally... people from Germany and people from England that I've taken out into our hinterlands here, and all they wanted, not really all they wanted, but they really wanted to see that newt in the wild. They knew the broken striped newt existed. It's amazing, because there are people that live here that have no idea about our very own newt, so named because it has a bright red broken stripe that runs the length of its body. South of us is the striped newt. North of us is the spotted newt. But in southeastern North Carolina, it's the broken striped newt. That's our very own subspecies.
So many questions about that, but we have a lot of jars. There are very active fish that look like they're not happy to be in a small jar, and they
right.
don't look like they're used to it either.
No.
Can you describe the fish?
Yeah, 2 hours ago they were in 100 gallons, and now they're in a peanut butter jar of clean water, but they're just disoriented for the time. If we drop this jar of Daphnia in there, they would just devour them.
You're talking about the mosquito fish.
Mosquito fish, yep.
What are these guys over here that are larger
than this? Oh, tadpoles, sorry.
Oh, those are tadpoles.
Yep, which look fish-like. So these are southern leopard frog tadpoles. And in about 2 weeks, these will be froglets. They're already developing hind legs. They'll be absorbing their tail shortly, and they will transform into little froglets.
And you said there are so many different kinds of species of frog. What kind of frog are those? You said leopard?
Southern leopard frog, not to be confused with the northern leopard frog, which is, as his name implies, north of us. But we have, there are ponds no bigger than this studio that may support, in our area, that I've been in after a rainstorm and counted 8 species of frogs breeding in that one little pond the size of this studio. The frog diversity here is just staggering.
And you also have a jar of what looks like dirt.
Oh, southern toad. People are very familiar with toads because they come up onto your porch. They'll get under the porch light to feed on beetles and moths and other things that are drawn to the light. This is a female southern toad, and you can tell it's a female because she has a white chin. The male toad has a gray chin. And it is not true that toads give you warts. The bumps behind their eyes are called parotid glands, and those two glands produce a toxin that tastes a little like rotten lemon with a hint of Ajax.
I'm sorry, I'm pulling a George here. I'm coming over to say hello to the female toad. You can hold her, Andy. She's precious. But she looks different from the kinds of toads that you would see around a lot of suburban neighborhoods in Brunswick and New Hanover
County.
It's
the same toad.
It's the same toad.
And
she's
they can
just
actually
dirtier.
Change. No, she changes color. They actually can change color. So she's in dark pine bark mulch in this jar. If I put her on damp white paper towel, she'll go gray. And if you put her on to black soil, she'll get even darker brown than she is right now.
Wow.
And we have another toad called the oak toad, which is an animal that at full grown doesn't get much bigger than your thumbnail.
You had kind of a mathematical equation to help people understand the issue around species extinction. Why don't you go ahead and explain that to us?
Okay, thank you. And the reason I use math as part of a discussion about species diversity is I often am asked the question, so what's so important about a snail? That individual snail has a role to play, just as every other species has a role to play. If you ask what's the importance of a snail, what's the importance of a copepod or a daphnia, or any number of small things? So here's the math exercise in an aquatic system. First, visualize a food pyramid, just like what you see on a box of cereal. In this food pyramid, at the bottom of the base of the pyramid, are plants, the producers. Above the plants are eaters of plants. Above them are eaters of plants. Above them, eaters of eaters of eaters of plants. And then at the top is either a major predator, or you can put us at the very top. So here's the math exercise. We've got these little tiny planktonic animals, each one the size of a dot on a printed page. They are food for mosquito fish. Each mosquito fish weighs about 1 gram. In order to get to be 1 gram, each fish has to consume at least 10 grams of little teeinses. What eats a mosquito fish? A sunfish, like a bluegill sunfish. A 1 pound bluegill sunfish has to eat 10 pounds of mosquito fish, in turn 100 pounds of little teeinses. A largemouth bass eats sunfish. A 1 pound bass, 10 pounds of sunfish, 100 pounds of mosquito fish, 1,000 pounds of teeinses. We spend $150 million a year chasing bass. So there is a connection between economics and ecology.
And that's this edition of Coastline. Andy Wood, what a pleasure having you with us today. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Coastline's producer is Caitlin Freund. Technical director is Ken Campbell. Production manager is Caitlin Hanrahan. Coastline is a production of WHQR Public Media. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at whqr.org. Get the podcast, find it on the HQR app, or just tune in for the rebroadcast Sunday afternoon. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.